Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 84, section 3, which is old single column page 933. Okay, recall in the preceding session, we set the stage in terms of evolutionary progress to launch into what the immediate topic at hand here is, the father family, in contrast to the mother family, which preceded it. And I think basically the main thing I want to just remind you of, it you know, we've seen it in a number of different contexts, and we're seeing it again, that in terms of anything, any aspect of reality that you want to talk about, the evolutionary process is such that it begins almost wholly natural and ends completely unnatural. Personality managed, that is. That is the big arc of evolution, is that transition from what appears to just be sort of completely natural, obviously there's hidden underneath all of quote-unquote natural reality a personal author, but nonetheless, it in terms of the experiential domain, what you experience, you don't initially experience any sort of overt personality management, so it appears to all just be quote-unquote natural. When you're talking about an individual world, for instance, evolving towards light and life, and all the stages deep into light and life, very much so, you're taking that world from something that seemed to just coalesce out of the material processes of star formation and stuff rattling around in the galaxy and whatnot, and to eventually a world that strikes step with all of the architectural spheres, where every single automaton was individually assembled into place. Okay, that's the arc, that full artificial, that full art form of unnatural personality managed state of affairs. And so that this is what we're seeing in when we're looking at the evolution of marriage and the family, the home, is everything starts out just inescapably what's most immediate. And you have that maternal instinct, as they've pointed out, that is the natural predicate for how things initially organize themselves, sort of just, almost completely unconsciously on the part of the humans involved. So the mother family, that's the initial natural state. But as we saw, for things to move forward, you have to have greater flexibility. See, that only the originality of genuine free will can bring into existence. You could just kind of see behind the immediacy of what they were talking about in the mother family section there, that other things were evolving, and the sort of the raw naturalness of the mother family just couldn't deal with interfacing with all these other things that were moving forward. And so something had to give, and it did. And but, you know, in going to the unnaturalness of injecting more directionality into the institution of the home and of marriage, that, and like I said, you know, bringing in some initial measure of free will, that inescapably brings in the double-edged sword of, you know, at the very least, overplaying things and producing problems that are then going to have to be resolved in some way or another. We all know that there's such a tendency for us to be not very objective in our social evolution, so that you, you know, the pendulum drifts all the way to one end point, and eventually everyone wakes up to the problem of that, you know, and they just release all the latches, and the thing swings wildly all the way to the other side. You know, so, you know, it starts out pretty, pretty extreme, you know, this you know, this evolutionary adjustment process, where you, until you can damp out these wild oscillations, but nonetheless, it you have to introduce that potential for things to go awry unnaturally. Because unnatural it must be. It's just inescapable. It has to be unnatural. Otherwise, there's no place for personality. There's no place for free will. There's no place for choice. The naturalness of blobs of matter has no place for choice in it. Oxygen molecules don't get to choose their properties or anything, right? They just are what they are. Okay, so... so that's the key thing that we're you know, that we're doing, is we're making that transition. We're injecting this unnaturalness, and we've got to slowly sort out all the issues that arise because of the ignorance of our initial unnatural efforts. Okay, so let's see what they have to say here.
3, the family under father dominance. It may be that the instinct of motherhood led woman into marriage, but it was man's superior strength, together with the influence of the mores, that virtually compelled her to remain in wedlock. Pastoral living tended to create a new system of mores, the patriarchal type of family life, and the basis of family unity under the herder and the early agricultural mores was the unquestioned and arbitrary authority of the father. All society, whether national or familial, passed through the stage of the autocratic authority of a patriarchal order.
Okay, so you can see the very first paragraph, they're pointing out how this is going to be overplayed fundamentally. It's not just a father family. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be predicated on unquestioned and arbitrary authority. Yeah, it's just going to be, you know, completely autocratic. Just whatever the self finds natural, you know, that's going to be absolutized, existentialized, and imposed upon the family order. You know, remember the auto part of autocratic just means self. Right? You know, it's just that self is going to rule. You know, with whatever, you know, arbitrary nature and nurture, you know, it finds itself with. Okay. Okay. So, you know, and you know, notice that they mentioned, you know, the nature nurture right in the beginning there. You know, there's the natural part of man's superior strength, but then there's the whole moray issue, the whole, you know, how, you know, what nurturing we submit ourselves to. that you know, feeds into, as they mentioned before, this state of affairs that once you go from hunter to herder sets in under the herder mores, or the, you know, the pastoral living, like they're saying there. You know, you end up with these you know, very extreme biased states. You know, then it has to slowly come around and find a new and improved place for women in a better system. But it starts out pretty stark. But again, you know, we've pointed this out a number of times, that last sentence. You know, it's very easy for us when we read stuff like this and we have problems with the non-idyllic aspects of what's being said. It's very easy for us to think that, well, it's like this because of the rebellion and the default, and maybe throw in the decimal world stuff too, just for, you know, sake of argument. But it's not. I mean, so often, that's not the issue. It could be no rebellion, no default, you know, no decimal world, everything apparently by nature, you know, going splendidly. And you still have to go, it's still an evolutionary process. Everything has to go through these stages. There's no way to avoid what's natural, and then what is going to follow is unnatural, begins to be added into the system. You know, it doesn't matter if you're one brainer, two brainer, three brainer, you know, non-breather, you know, there's just none of that is going to change these very, very fundamental natural facts that lead to certain inescapable states of society, followed by what, you know, the same basic tensions that produce changes from that initial natural state. All society, whether national or familial, passed through the stage of the autocratic authority of a patriarchal order, and you can just see the way they stepped back and said it so sweeping, between the lines is, on every world, right? Not just your world. It's just the way it is. And that's always difficult for, if you have any reasonable spiritual consciousness, the tension between ideals and the evolutionary process is so difficult to resolve a lot of times. To not immediately think you have skin in the game, you know, as it were, you know, and think you should have some, you know, emotional response to this, or, you know, some opinion about it or whatnot, rather than just taking it at factually at face value and objectively.
I like the idea of superior strength, though.
Right, and you know, and then once you face the facts of the difference, like there's superior strength on the one side, then you can ask some better questions when you aren't hung up about it. It's like, well, okay, so why, you know, does one have superior strength? And, you know, and so you can start to penetrate into the mind of the creators if you start asking calm, probing why questions apart from ideological, you know, visceral responses, and you might actually begin to love the creator all the more when you can begin to really discover your, you know, through your own reflective thinking, why it has to be that way. It's like, well, I guess now that I think about it, if I was the author of all this, I, you know, in my infinite wisdom, I would have had to have done it the same way. Any way else would have not been the best. Right? You know that the way everything plays out is the best way, if you're humble. So, you know, to begin to be able to feel like you can appreciate why that is the best, see, that's a little measure of godlikeness. You're getting up and starting to play with the sixth level of meaning a little bit. You're beginning to rise above, you know, your natural animal origin visceral responses to things. Did you have something?
Well, it kind of... a weird way that it makes sense. Naturally, man is stronger. So when an autocrat acts, you know, we tend to, by what right?
Yeah.
By
yeah.
what right
yeah.
can you do this?
Mm-hmm.
Well, by right of superior strength.
Might makes
that's,
right. Yeah, it's quite a good
thing. That's natural.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to be unnatural, we need to bring into play by what right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a legitimate question.
Mm-hmm.
To go from the natural to the artificial.
Yeah. Yeah. And
but you still have to accept the fact
right.
of the superior strength. It's like, mind does not make right, but it does make what is.
Yes. Yeah. All right. And I mean, it's just, as long as you brought that up, it's just a little technical issue. You may have never paused to think about. You know, when we talk about various modes of governance, you know, in a general sense, you know, sometimes we have words that end in archy, like patriarchy, you know, matriarchy, you know, and that archy part means rule. And other times we have words that end in, you know, you know, like crat, you know, or CRA, you know, like democracy, you know, and cracy, you know, or autocracy. You know, and a lot of times you say like democracy, the rule of the people. It's like, well, okay, so there's two suffixes that mean rule? Well, yes and no. I mean, the CRACY part of autocracy, you could say means rule, but also in a way that the archy were, you know, suffix doesn't, means power or strength. Okay? So, see, you know, it's very appropriate, you know, when we see autocracy for you to think of, oh, okay, really kind of fundamentally more than ruling, we're talking about just power or strength. See, ruling today. You know, it's like, you know, when we say power to the people. See, that's really just a way of expanding the literalness of the word democracy. You know, so, yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, superior strength, like I said, I mean, maybe even in the most direct sense, that suffix C-R-A-C-Y means strength. And it's right there in the same paragraph that they bring that up. See, so that, you know, there's always a richness there that you can recognize and appreciate all the more, you know, what's going on. This isn't, there's like you were pointing out, there's a high degree of naturalness still in play. You know, we haven't gone totally artificial here. The naturalness of the superior strength is definitely in play. Yeah. But, you know, you're moving towards, like I said, eventually you're going to have, you know, a type of rule, a ruling that, you know, is transcendent of all naturalness. And, of course, that's when you don't need any external government at all anymore, right? Because there's complete self-mastery of, you know, your mind is completely personality managed, and the external world is just handled automatically by what flows out of such completely mastered selves. You know, you don't need to have someone forcing certain arrangements of molecules out there in the external world. The arrangements just come from that predicate of what's the law that's written in the heart, you know, as it were.
Yep. I was talking to somebody at a conference, and he was describing, you know, how he was describing what you just described there, and it was how an orchestra gets together, and they don't really need a conductor; they just know what to do, and they just blend mm-hmm. together.
Yep.
And I was arguing the point: they need a supreme chief right now. He didn't like hearing that too much.
Right, but see, right, that's.
Yeah. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, obviously, initially, I mean, a local universe needs a supreme chief, quote unquote, right? a creator son and master son for a long time. Once the local universe is settled in light and life, okay, it's a little different, okay? Right? And it's very easy for us with our spiritual consciousness to leap all the way forward to one of those sorts of states.
Like Lucifer did.
Right, like Lucifer was wanting to do and encouraging everyone else to do. But no, for a long time, there has to be a definitive external directionizing. You don't just have all the internal directions, which coincidentally are all aligned because they're all internally synchronized with the cosmos. Yeah. Before that, there has to be someone externally who is imposing that cosmic, superimposing that cosmic directioning.
But Michael doesn't start out
as sovereign. He doesn't start out as a sovereign, no.
With unquestioned sovereignty.
Yeah, and it just...
So that throws a wrinkle.
Yeah, well, see, that's right. That's why, you have to trust in the seemingly problematic natural stuff before things are really clamped down. That, there'll be some rebellions and whatnot, but when all is said and done, just like all of the, just not to mention the difficulties when you had a mother family like we talked about, but all of the problems of then transitioning. It's like, well, man, why couldn't we just avoided all of that, like all of the problems of the transition by having them, the universe initiate us, kind of closer to the end point than. But that's not the way it works. We have to start in a very, very amorphous, undirected state. Yeah. Because we are the counterpoint to the central universe where everything starts out spot on aligned, we can't have two elements pre-aligned. Everything has to be, in a basically random direction to begin with, and slowly everything starts to crystallize and come into alignment. It's just, either everything's aligned or nothing's aligned, right? And there's no in between. Those are the two initial states.
So, very low energy creatures, when they start out, can participate in their slow speed,
right?
In the evolution of creation.
Yeah, I mean.
And then when they get up higher, they're operating at higher levels, higher, faster thinking, and.
Yeah, right. I mean, you have to be able to hit the ground running when your first foot plants, in Havona on the pilot world of the Seventh Circuit, okay? I mean, there's, you have to have perfection of purpose. I mean, it's 1,000 miles an hour the moment that your foot steps down, right? Right, but like you're saying, it has to all be able to handle a very slow, confused, ignorant state of affairs to begin with here. And that amorphous, randomized state is, matches that. Yeah. Did you have some?
Yeah, I mean, without this time-space technique, that would never, there wouldn't be any ascending scheme or any other scheme.
Yeah.
Time-space technique is, a study. Look what just walked into Havona.
Right. I mean, again, because we start out, not, definitively, eternally purposed all the way down to the foundation, you, as a free will being, can participate in those very foundational directionizing phases. No Havona native had any choice in such things. All they could do is, add a particular flavor of cherry on top. The whole sundae is built for them. Okay? They had no choice. So, you get to decide what kind of bowl to put it in and everything, right?
Someone just brought a Monday.
All right. Okay. So anyway, back to the issue. So yeah, like they're saying there, we're obviously switching from matriarchy to patriarchy, and you know everyone knows how problematic patriarchy has been over the centuries, as they're about to remind us here.
The scant courtesy paid womankind during the Old Testament era is a true reflection of the mores of the herdsmen. The Hebrew patriarchs were all herdsmen, as is witnessed by the saying, "The Lord is my shepherd."
Okay, so right, just a quick little statement to remind you of what you probably all know about the Old Testament predicate for so much of our culture that we still struggle relative to. But go beyond that immediacy and you know, why there's so much railing against patriarchy and whatnot in our culture these days. Think about what they reminded you of there. That saying, "The Lord is my shepherd." And remember what they've told you back in paper 48 about the 23rd Psalm. All right? What was actually whispered, you know, into young David's ear?
"Gods are my caretakers."
All right, "the gods are my caretakers." Exactly. All right, back there in, was that section 6? Yeah, section 6 of paper 48. See, but that shepherd couldn't wrap his mind around, you know, first of all, gods, okay, the plural of it, but, you know, even "gods are my caretakers." Caretaker for him was heard as shepherd. Okay? Because, like they're saying here, they're, you know, these are herdsmen. Right? And so, just, you know, their your whole frame of mind, you know, is a pastoral framework. And, you know, the celestials or whatnot can, you know, your adjuster or whatnot can speak to such a mind with such a framework, and you can't hear anything except a pastoral framework, you know, what will fit into a pastoral framework, right? So he heard, you know, or kind of could remember, "The Lord is my shepherd."
Could that be because his job, people's jobs at that time was their whole life?
Right.
16 hours a day, maybe.
I mean, very much. See, it's just okay, that's what
his frame of thinking couldn't get beyond.
Right. That's all he knows, and so that's all he could really, you know, ingest. So, see, they're reminding you of that, just how fundamental that is. You know, you could say, "Well, man, couldn't you know, celestial beings have tweaked this a little bit?" No. You know, your evolutionary state's your evolutionary state. You know, like I say so often, I can sit here and talk for endless hours, but if you haven't chosen to reform the framework of your mind, if it's still the old wineskin, you're not actually going to hear anything that the revelators are saying. They're going to say, "The gods are my caretakers," and you're going to hear, "The Lord is my shepherd." Okay? You know, we all know how difficult it is for even very long-time readers of the Urantia book to actually think plural about the word God. Right? It's still basically just everything they're reading just goes into the monotheism framework, and you don't really hear any of the multiplicity of personalized deity. So, yeah, so but anyway, you know, kind of, you know, back to the issue, immediate issue at hand here. You know, all even the tweaking from planetary administration was subject to this sort of inescapable process of going from hunter to herder, you know, and like they're about to point out, eventually to farmer and the transitions. It just you know, not only is that kind of inescapable, but if beings from on high, like Caligashi and crew, try to somehow make it otherwise, get the people to somehow really hear things outside of their context, then you have pandemonium. And eventually it'll all settle back to that context and what fits into it anyway. You can't somehow demand that the supreme be in a different state of evolution. It's in the state it's in, right? And no one can change that. Ancients of Days can't change that. You know, it just is what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
But what you're doing with PHI is kind of out of the context, and it's a cutting edge thing.
Yeah.
But it's appropriate, obviously, or else.
Yeah. See, your inner life, right, where you're sovereign. Right, you aren't subject to this, what I'm talking about. But it's just when you think, well, now that I've got it all reformed in my inner life, I'm going to try to make that, you know, rule the outer life. You know, it's not going to work. You know, you can't make it go faster out there, but you can make it turn on a dime inside. You know, if you're ready to, then just let go of all that stuff, and you control the pace at which things reform, because you're sovereign there.
For the most part, it's not appropriate to put forth some of the stuff we learn here.
Yeah.
It's better to say something different in a different way,
more like
in a different context.
Yeah, right? I mean, you start with, you know, if you can find someone who's in a similar ready state like you are, ready for significant change, you know, if both of you are taking these big steps forward in your inner life, the mutual edification of sharing that one with the other is wonderful. But, you know, there's only going to be a few like that. Most of the people you're going to be engaging, you know, you have to respect where they are, especially if they're very locked into the evolutionary process. You know, and anything else for them would be just too terrifying. You got to respect that, because the Supreme's evolution is dependent upon lots of people being locked in to the evolutionary process. It's dependent upon me being locked in to some degree, you know. I'm not independent of the Supreme. We're all within the womb of the Universal Mother right now, of the finite. You know, and so that evolution of the total finite is dependent on each and every one of us being to some degree kind of just, you know, locked in to the glacier, you know, and its movement. But then there's others that, you know, they're almost just 100%, you know, which means that the Supreme very, very much needs them, and you need to respect that. You know, and when you don't respect that, that's when you're thinking like Lucifer, you know. That's when you're getting, you know, you're putting yourself above the whole. Okay. All right, so here we are with this this pastoral state of affairs, and it's very difficult for womankind, as they're saying. What else do they tell us here?
But man was no more to blame for his low opinion of women during past ages than was woman herself. She failed to get social recognition during primitive times because she did not function in an emergency. She was not a spectacular or crisis hero. Maternity was a distinct disability in the existence struggle. Mother love handicapped women in the tribal defense.
Yeah, so definitely that security age stage of the development, you know, the developmental epics, like they're pointing to there. That inescapably, you know, produces a bias. You know, so they're telling you every world is like this. There's just no way that you can't, that the world can't go through a state where women don't get a lot of respect. The security age is just the rules of that age are harsh, right, in this regard. The moment that she follows her foundational instinct and turns and tries to protect the child, right, the guy with the battle axe just kills them both. The epic poem that's written, doesn't include her. Kind of in a bigger sense, so notice how they started that out. They know that we need to be challenged and not think simplistically as they're telling us this stuff. And, they point at this is, you want equality between men and women? Well, men and women are equally to blame here. Okay? That's your first, dose of facing equality is equal blame, And then we'll eventually get to, equal honors. But it starts with, facing equal blame. And man was no more to blame for his low opinion of woman during past ages than was woman herself. And we are, the interesting thing as this paper shifts into all the issues related to father family, the more on the surface it appears we're focusing on patriarchy. Actually, what really is happening is more and more all the females reading the Revelation are being challenged. Right? They're building up to the challenge. Because even if initially it doesn't seem like liberty is equally there for men and women, once you go from natural to unnatural, liberty will eventually be in both hands. And with liberty comes responsibility. And there, and they, because it's not so natural for women to have a lot of freedom to begin with, on every world, there's a delayed assumption of facing the facts of responsibility once you're given freedom. And so now that's what they're building up to. It's just trying to really get people to recognize that. So you say you want liberty. Well, do you know what that means? Okay. As soon as you have liberty, it's a double-edged sword, true and false liberty.
Chris, this might be fundamental, but mother love is never going to go away.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They're going to mention that. Right.
Yeah. Bigger
than you. Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. They're going to stress that because obviously, when all is said and done, it doesn't matter if you're in the seventh stage of light and life. Every female still has maternal instinct.
It's kind of not our job to function in the crisis as much as it should be the guys.
Right.
Not our job.
Right. It's just inescapably there will always be this difference. The sophistication of civilization is how elegantly, how creatively you face those facts and adjust them to ideals and have a wise system, right?
Yeah. I don't think they were saying we need to overcome that or something.
Yeah,
but just that the battle axe is the thing that got the glory.
Yeah.
And the security. When you said that, you were talking about a woman being a battle axe.
Now, don't put that on him.
That's a different
battle axe.
That's what was happening before the father dominance took hold.
That can still happen.
Yeah, anyway. Were you done?
They're just saying why women didn't have a higher esteem at that time, because all the glory that, got distributed went to people with battle axes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because they provided the security. That was
Yeah. Right. Like, that's why I stress. See, it's very, very heightened in the security age. Obviously, as you move towards the quest for knowledge and wisdom, I think things can change. But man, you know, when you're in the security age, right, the physical difference is just a big thing.
Well, you see what they're going
to
say now.
Okay.
Primitive women also unintentionally created their dependence on the male by their admiration and applause for his pugnacity and virility. This exaltation of the warrior elevated the male ego while it equally depressed that of the female and made her more dependent. A military uniform still mightily stirs the feminine emotions.
Yeah, so again, see, just like the preceding paragraph, okay, there's blame to go around here, okay? we all need to appreciate what our Achilles' heels are, you know, in this process. And you notice it's getting pricklier. They start the paragraph off with primitive women. It's like, well, that doesn't apply to any of us. We're modern women. It's like, well, okay. right. You know, primitive women can mean two things. It could mean, you know, women back in primitive times or women in current times that are, yeah, yeah, still functioning in a quite primitive modality. In other words, you know, and by primitive, you just mean a very, very natural beginning, instinctual way. You know, they're just reminding you have this instinct. There's no off switch for it. It's never going to go away. You're going to have to figure out how to be the master of that instinct and not have it be the last word all the time in the way you conduct your life. You know, so, you know, just in the same way men have to face their Achilles' heels, women have to face theirs too. And that's the whole point of self-mastery, is to not be a helpless victim of these instincts that you can't ever turn off. You know, so pugnacity and virility, you know, that whole combative spirit. You know, if the field of combat is the football field, coincidentally, there are cheerleaders. Yeah. Okay? That's a simple example of what we're talking about. You know, and that I don't think there's any ankle chains on those cheerleaders. All right? They're not enslaved to that task.
Fancier uniform.
Right.
Or conveniences.
Yeah, so the exaltation of the warrior, yeah, you know, see, so you, and it's just, when you're in this very natural modality, notice how it's kind of a zero-sum game. I mean, the degree to which you over-exalt the male ego is the degree to which you depress the female ego. I mean, it's just a zero-sum game. The only way to escape that kind of zero-sum situation is for personality to enter in and be an originating phenomenon, right? A genuinely creative phenomenon. Otherwise, if it's raining more in one part of the planet, it has to be raining less on another part of the planet because there isn't suddenly more or less water on the planet. You know, it didn't go off into space or something or come in from space. Right? Things are just a zero-sum game, you know, unless you bring in personality and creativity.
Like you point out, those are differentials. What's that going to drive in that case?
Yep.
Going to drive the necessity of personality coming in there.
Yep. Yeah. And you know, again, remember we were pointing to the security age. So immediately, it's like, well, we know, you know, the material comfort era follows that, and go, oh yeah, that's right. The whole point of the material comfort era is for all these differentiations that get started before that, You know, they get taken to their extremes where everyone goes, wait a minute, we need to rise above this and start to become the authors of this more, you know, instead of just being helpless victims of how this pushes us about. You know, and then you begin the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Yeah, so the differentials in all their harshness are the potentializing of the greater things to come.
And then there's examples of women who rise to the occasion in a male-dominated society and become leaders.
Yeah.
It's kind of an indication. Well, to do that, they have to exhibit a lot of personality.
Yeah.
They can't just fall in there naturally.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and that's why very successful women leaders and, you know, say civil leaders, they tend to not be a narrowly expressed individual, because like you're pointing out, there has to be some genuine personality there, and the fullness that inescapably comes with that. Right? It's not just going to be, well, you know, they just have a natural ability along this line. You know, you discover that they are quite a multidimensional personality. Right? So again, like I said, I mean, once you get personality in play, which is neither male nor female, all this stuff can be transcended. But when you're just your animal origin sex, you're kind of just stuck with all the Achilles heels and the blind spots of that sex, limitations of that sex. Okay, so anyway, back to the point. So they, two paragraphs in a row, they're trying to get us to see how we both are unwitting authors of these less than idyllic states that we find ourselves in. You know, it isn't like we're so often taught these days, you know, that, oh, it's all the men's fault. You know, women didn't have anything to do with it. You know, that's false. No.
Chris?
Yep.
I was just thinking with Rada and Adamson, you know, talk about sexual attraction.
You know, it's always kind of a little tongue in cheek, but you know, there's a reason why I always make that sort of irreverent comment of about that evening with Eve and Kano. Yeah. Okay, you can't have some goofy notion in your head that Eve is not a female. No, his bronze pecs were glistening in the moonlight. Okay, and that's significant, right? She's not somehow not like you. Okay, immune to all of those instinctual responses and stuff.
Yeah, that was after he.
I mean, it's just these things are just, you know, we have to face these facts about what we are, you know, and over time we can maybe better understand why we're that way. But step one is just, you know, acknowledging that you're that way. Know thyself, right? Is step one.
That was after he overcame Sarah Tasha. Setting up Kano, overcame all her objections to get close enough to her to have that.
Right, see, again, like I was trying to point out, you overcome all of the unnatural overruling of natural tendencies, and then there's issues.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, like she was warned right up front. Okay, you have certain natural tendencies, remember, that have to be unnaturally, you know, controlled all the time. We're not going to turn off your natural tendencies. That's not the point of the evolutionary domain. So, yeah, okay, anyway. So they start, anyway, back to what I was saying. They're telling you that there's both are kind of equally in play in setting this up. Now they're going to, you know, you notice we have a big paragraph break coming up. We've got an initial little element we have to add yet.
Among the more advanced races, women are not so large or so strong as men. Woman, being the weaker, therefore became the more tactful. She early learned to trade upon her sex charms. She became more alert and conservative than man, though slightly less profound. Man was woman's superior on the battlefield and in the hunt. But at home, woman has usually outgeneraled even the most primitive of men.
Yeah, there's the general out there, and then there's the general in the home. Yes, dear. And notice, you know, that if they start out by stressing that this difference between male and female is accentuated when the humans are less primitive. See, so again, you just see how the whole point is for this difference to be very definitive. So the only way things can go forward is if personality that's transcendent of all these differences is the dominant phenomenon in the society. When personality can't be very profound, there isn't as much difference between men and women. Because if there was an extreme difference, it would all blow up, you know, day one of humanity, you know, and we'd never get off the starting block. So again, when you think about going to light and life, it's going to be all the more spiritual until finally it's all just a smooth continuum and there's no differences. No. See, underlying this wonderful, harmonious society are very, very stark differentials that have been completely mastered, you know, and are played like a fine orchestra with differences between tubas and piccolos. Okay? That's the whole point. They'll just keep dialing up the contrasts the better we get at personality management until we have to have 500 balls, you know, in the air in our juggling act all at the same time. You'll just keep tossing balls into your juggling act. Yeah. And one can only imagine what it must be like in seventh stage light in life. Just, you know, how masterly everyone is at this. And that reminds me of that perfection of purpose that I have to have before they'll let me into Havona. All right, you step down and they hand you a million balls that you have to be juggling instantly. And you do it perfectly.
In a billion ball system.
Yeah. It's just, that's the way it is.
So can we look forward as women to always being slightly less profound?
Well,
what do they mean by that?
Okay, good. I'm glad you brought that up. So why do they mean slightly less profound? Well, you know, it's relative. They were giving you hints earlier on, that whole bit about why she was not a spectacular or crisis hero. You know, in that same mode, right? I mean, what is it society considers profound? Right? It's relative to, you know, society's expectations or whatnot. She's just stuck in this more prosaic part of the society, not the poetic part. So she's quote unquote slightly less profound. It's not profound to do a great job in the vegetable garden, but it's deemed to be profound, you know, to do a great job on the battlefield or whatever, you know, or in the corporate boardroom or, you know, whatever the heck it might be. Yeah. Let's see. Anything else there we want to get before? That's right. I wanted to, you know, notice how sneaky evolution is in bringing, more refined elements into the system. you know, you start out, everything is coarse. You know, how are you going to bring refinement into the system? Well, in a way that you wouldn't expect, you set up this very harsh tension, difference between men and women, but women respond by bringing refinement, right? She became more tactful, right? So this whole bit of, see, as soon as you start to really get this tension, coincidentally, she becomes even more the civilizer than she is naturally. She starts to have to respond unnaturally to the state of affairs and does so kind of building upon her civilizer maternal instinct that she began with naturally. Right? So you start to bring tact, you know, and men can eventually learn tact from women. The whole bit about became more alert and conservative. As opposed to, you know, everyone knows what's on the guy's tombstone. It seemed like a good idea at the time. Right? His natural antithetical tendency relative to alertness and conservativeness, right? And he's just living in the moment and the delights of the moment, you know, and very blinders on directionalized, right? So there's no peripheral vision. He's not really alert. And he's definitely not thinking about carrying things forward into the future. He's just living for the moment, so he's not conservative. Those refinements, those more sophisticated thoughts, came in response to women getting, you know, depressed in the society, and then, you know, having to reach deep, right, to not just be erased, kind of, right? Yeah. So, you know, that's all. That evolution is a very sneaky process, this way.
Bit of a whack-a-mole.
I like the
out-generaled part. Usually out-generaled, right? And again, it all starts out in a very crude fashion. The sex urge nose ring, right, that the guy has, right? Like they're pointing out, to trade upon her sex charms, But it's a very crude way, but it begins to bring it. She gets a chance to start practicing generaling. The guys have been practicing forever out on the battlefield. Right, it gives her an opportunity to have to face some of the logistic issues and whatnot, and the practical aspects of all this, and so it's a process. Okay.
The herdsman looked to his flocks for sustenance, but throughout these pastoral ages, women must provide the vegetable food. Primitive man shunned the soil; it was altogether too peaceful, too unadventuresome. There was also an old superstition that women could raise better plants. They were mothers. In many backward tribes today, the men cook the meat, the women the vegetables, and when the primitive tribes of Australia are on the march, the women never attack game, while a man would not stoop to dig a root.
Okay, so guys, if you think of yourself as a progressive guy, because you're cooking too on the grill. Okay, you need to grill the vegetables, not just the meat. Otherwise, that backward tribe thing is in play.
Since I'm the only one who can operate the grill anyway, what's a grill to do?
But, you know, it's just so funny the way they throw in those things where it appears they're talking about people in the past. But not really, right?
You just have to think of a barbecue.
All you have to do is like, wait a minute, they're talking about me. Yeah, they are, right?
I can't get it to lie.
Yeah, this isn't the book that discloses the facts of the past. This is a book that's a revelation of truth. So every sentence is about you, really. Very direct, trying to poke you a little bit. get you to think outside of the old boxes. Again, we remember the too peaceful, too unadventuresome. Remember, we had that line we ended with last time. This change to the father family led at once to greater social expression and increased family adventure. Just because of that, it's just too place-like. That's what you really mean by peaceful and unadventurous. It's just too place-like. The guy wants some directionality, even if it's slamming his head into a brick wall. It's exciting just because it's directional.
She'll tape it up.
Okay. I'm fully aware of my Achilles heels as a male. Right? Let's keep going here.
Woman has always had to work. At least right up to modern times, the female has been a real producer. Man has usually chosen the easier path, and this inequality has existed throughout the entire history of the human race. Woman has always been the burden bearer, carrying the family property and tending the children, thus leaving the man's hands free for fighting or hunting.
Again, this is another way of, in terms of the big picture, of talking about what we were just talking about a little bit more. Notice they use the modifier real. Female has been a real producer. So in other words, it isn't just serving that moment of time. Seemed like a good idea at the time, right? It's in contrast to that. Again, because even though it appears that the maternal instinct is just about the immediacies of that moment of mother and child, remember we talked about that greater sophistication of using the first adjutant actually brings in a spiritual nature, so it isn't just the energy of instinct, but the spirit of intuition, which means it brings in some of your intuition and your encirclement in the Holy Spirit, which means it brings in eternity and not just that moment in time. So they throw in little modifiers like that to, remind you that females unwittingly begin to bring in an eternalization, despite the fact, remember when they talk about Adam and Eve and they have that very problematic statement about women's tendency to be impatient because they want immediate results and not thinking for the long term. But despite those instincts, they're reminding you that she can't help but under certain circumstances to actually bring eternity in spite of herself. Okay. So they're reminding you of that, and man has usually chosen the easier path, like they're saying, and this inequality has existed throughout the entire history of the human race. So again, don't get out of the ideological conditioning that we have about these things these days. This is just the way it is, okay? It has nothing to do with ideology or whether it's paternalism or maternalism or whatever ism it is. You've got these natural differentials that at the same time direction is an important thing to add to a certain situation. Don't forget about how that kind of biases you towards time. Whereas place biases you towards eternity. I mean, think about the Isle of Paradise when they say things like it's timeless, and spaceless. It's just that it just the place is, right? See, it's kind of just naturally, you know, brings in a little bit of an existential flavor that this directionality in the moment doesn't. And so that's what they're between the lines, they're reminding you of that.
They're also saying something about work. Work says elsewhere that work is the efforts of design.
Uh-huh.
So if a man doesn't have to work, he's not really forward thinking. He may be directionalized, but he's
right.
Not forward.
Forward thinking, right? Yeah. Yeah, there's no foresight. Yeah, I mean, just because there's, yeah, a great point as you're making, just because there's an instinctual directional sense, that doesn't mean he's foresightful. Yeah, because again, oops, it seemed like a good idea at the time. That's a lack of foresight and insight and wisdom. There's lots of fun things here if you notice the little details. Let's see here. Anything else there? The fact that he said man is usually chosen. Okay. See, so you know they're reminding you of how you bring in some existentializing of your animal origin tendencies. Inescapably. And it makes it all the more difficult to change them then. And you've kind of locked them in.
I've observed a lot of women who went for a career and family ended up with two full-time jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And they still are the one who does the housework. And
right.
Is still in 2018, almost 19.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's almost always what I observe.
Yeah, and they're just kind of reminding you there, you know, you might try to blame all that on the mores system, the nurture thing, but, you know, there's a huge element of just it's just the nature of the beast, you know, the way we are. It isn't that women were just forced to always be the burden bearer. You notice it says, woman has always been the burden bearer, just the way they say it, see? Rather than she's always been forced to be the burden bearer. They didn't say it that way. So they're trying to remind you, just this is just kind of the way your instinct goes.
Well, it's the adding the full-time career didn't really work out. Like, it probably isn't worth it a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, just skip it. Like, I was a stay-at-home mom as long as I could be.
Yeah.
I thought it was my God-given right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
Yeah, and they're gonna get to that stuff. And I'm just trying to set it up. You know, the way they're stressing us, we need to face the facts of our nature, because if we're ever gonna go forward and have a better system where men and women don't have all of this unnecessary tension between them, that's predicated on us facing the facts of what we are. We can't say, I believe that I'm everything that I'm not. Let's start with that assumption and go, no, we can't go anywhere with a false assumption. We have to start with what we are, you know, and recognize certain things cannot be changed. Like you were pointing out, women will always have maternal instinct. That's just inescapable. And men will always have a sex urge, right, of equal magnitude right next to that fact. It's not going to change. You know, women can't demand that men somehow turn that off any more than men can demand that women just turn off their maternal instinct. There's no off switch on those things. They just are. If you want to, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it. Okay, don't start with, well, he didn't have a sex urge. No, then what's the point of even thinking about Jesus if you don't think about a real Jesus, the man, right? You have to start with, you know, something that needs to be mastered in order to admire his self-mastery. Okay.
Rebecca pushed the issue.
Yeah, all right, yes. Exactly. All right, let's keep going here.
Woman's first liberation came when man consented to till the soil, consented to do what had theretofore been regarded as woman's work. It was a great step forward when male captives were no longer killed but were enslaved as agriculturists. This brought about the liberation of woman so that she could devote more time to homemaking and child culture.
So again, there's another one of these. You know, to bring in these refinements, you have to introduce slavery. Yeah, another aspect of why slavery is indispensable in those beginning stages. You know, if women want, you're going to be able to evolve to a more liberated state, this is the, it's through slavery that that happens. You know, so when you think about how, you know, how active women were, you know, in the abolition movement, for instance, yeah, it's kind of an interesting, coming back around full circle. You know, again, these things that are just inescapable. This is, you know, this is the way it plays out in every world. Women begin to find more freedom and begin to bring in refinements into civilization because of slavery. That indispensable, that first indispensable.
When the slaves became ill or injured, it was usually the woman who tended to them and brought them back to health.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, and so you begin to develop nursing skills, you know, and you know, caring for the sick skills. And of course, you know, everyone knows how much of a role the women played, you know, in that regard, in Jesus' ministry. You know, all those things that kind of, it's like, well, I have this maternal instinct, and it could be less narrowly focused. I could generalize off of that beginning. You know, I could be inspired by that and, you know, apply it in a more general sense. That doesn't happen naturally. You see, she can unnaturally choose to direct that instinct in, you know, in different towards different ends, down different avenues. All right.
The provision of milk for the young led to earlier weaning of babies, hence to the bearing of more children by the mothers thus relieved of their sometimes temporary barrenness, while the use of cow's milk and goat's milk greatly reduced infant mortality. Before the herding stages of society, mothers used to nurse their babies until they were 4 and 5 years old.
Yeah, and if it wasn't all clear, kind of all comes clear when they throw in that final thing, when you think about how long they were nursing, it's like, well, what if she stops producing milk? Oh my goodness. Yeah. So like they're saying, it greatly reduced infant mortality to bring in animal milk and then the issues of temporary infertility. So all of this here you're seeing, you don't have cow's milk and goat's milk until you go from hunter to herder again, see? So, you know, there's these negative things about going to herder, like we've been talking about. Well, there's positive things too. Just focusing on women's place in society and the issues she's dealing with, that's going from hunter to herder is this double-edged sword. It's not all just negative. So again, just, you can just, they're trying to keep reminding you of just how clever the whole evolutionary process is. You know, what an infinite mind produces. How everything ends up having a purpose when all is said and done. And it all fits together in just an amazing weave. All right.
Decreasing primitive warfare greatly lessened the disparity between the division of labor based on sex. But women still had to do the real work, while men did picket duty. No camp or village could be left unguarded day or night. But even this task was alleviated by the domestication of the dog. In general, the coming of agriculture has enhanced women's prestige and social standing. At least this was true up to the time man himself turned agriculturist. As soon as man addressed himself to tilling the soil, there immediately ensued great improvements in methods of agriculture, extending on down through successive generations. In hunting and war, man had learned the value of organization, and he introduced these techniques into industry, and later, when taking over much of woman's work, greatly improved on her loose methods of labor.
Right, so that's what I was pointing out. See, in this, you know, that you know, they're pointing out this, you know, you might think that this is all just a nature difference. But see, another point, no, it has a lot to do with nurture and passing that, you know, what the fruits of that those learning experiences down from generation to generation. You know, man learned about organization and stuff, see. It isn't just he's just born that way. And it gets passed from father to son. And, you know, so you can just see between the lines, well, when women are, you know, are liberated more, they have to start this whole process of learning through experience and passing that down from generation to generation like men have been doing for a very, very long time. It isn't just all going to magically be there. It should help men to think about, you know, men always, you know, this whole bit about the way men are pointing out that men have this tendency to look down their nose at women. It's like, you know, oh, they're just, you know, they're not very organized and, you know, et cetera. It's like, well, remember, it's not like you're magically that way either. You know, that's something that has been learned and handed down. You know, be a little bit more humble about it. And also notice what a tendency you have to seek the path of least resistance. They're reminding you there. Okay, well, you know, someone's got to, you know, watch the village. So I'll do picket duty, you know, and meanwhile, you know, behind me, you know, you do all the work. You know, notice they said the real work there. Again, real work. Yeah. And you go, well, once you got domesticated dogs, I mean, isn't that it? No, he's still out there doing picket duty. It's just now he can sleep while he's doing it. And while the dog watches, he still isn't back there doing any real work. Okay?
Fred
Flintstone. After his 8 days in bed from her having...
You know, he just tells the dog, wake me up if there's anything, you know, mysterious, you know. And, you know, he takes a nap. Meanwhile, you know, she's grinding her fingers to the bone.
There's still a tension today. Men will more more readily accept a hierarchical structure. Uh-huh. And women often bridle against that.
Yeah.
Against letting another woman take the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And work under that direction. It's not.
Yeah.
They don't do it as readily.
And just, you know, again, see, men didn't do that naturally to begin with. They had to, they discovered that when they tried to beat the neighboring tribe, where they were leading their forces by committee, the neighboring tribe that was leading it in a hierarchical structure beat them. Oh, that's not a good idea. This horizontal thing, you know, we need a vertical, we need a hierarchy here. Right? I mean, you know, that's what they're pointing out, those sorts of things. And everyone has to face these facts. The universe has a hierarchy because hierarchy is better than anarchy, you know, horizontal. But, you know, Lucifer could imagine otherwise, you know, oh, we don't need hierarchy. You know, it can all just be a horizontal thing, an anarchy. It's important to, you know, think about those two words as contrast. I mean, you know, anarchy is not just rebellion, okay? I mean, it's in contrast, it's horizontal in contrast to vertical. You know, no vertical is basically, you know, what, you know, effectively anarchy means. No hierarchy. All right, let's see. Is there anything else there we needed to get? Let's see. I think we got it all there, didn't we? I think we're ready to, I guess, get a little bit more here about how this evolves forward.
4, woman's status in early society. Generally speaking, during any age, woman's status is a fair criterion of the evolutionary progress of marriage as a social institution, while the progress of marriage itself is a reasonably accurate gauge registering the advances of human civilization.
So that's kind of an interesting way to start. You notice that's set off by a large paragraph break, just a little opening thought, a little kind of mathematics, if you will, almost of it. Helping you to appreciate how you can get a handle on these more abstract things, you know, like human civilization. Okay, that's a pretty abstract thing. It's like, well, is there some thing that I can focus on more analytically, you know, to kind of be a gauge for the progress of that more abstract thing that's hard to measure? You know, so they're giving you that sense. And notice that they're reminding you of this. You have this very basic foundational litmus test, if you will, to the whole issue of human civilization, you know, right there in front of you with women's status. Yeah, which is much more tangible and gaugeable, if you will. Okay. So women's status, you know, allows you to really measure the progress of marriage, and that, you know, is a measure of the progress of civilization. So again, we see what we're talking about when they use the word real there, how inescapably, no matter how much it seems like women can be, you can have a society where women are very marginalized, not really, because by nature, they're a foundational element in their maternal instinct. They found the whole phenomenon. So, you know, eventually this fact has to be faced, or their civilization doesn't go anywhere. It all rests upon the foundation of integrity of women. And so, you know, a civilization is just doomed if women start using their free will to erase their innate integrity. Right? It's all built upon that foundation. Right? You know, sure, it's problematic when you have rogue males, but if you have rogue females, you can kiss civilization goodbye. That's, you know, that's knocking the very foundation off from the whole edifice. All right.
Woman's status has always been a social paradox. She has always been a shrewd manager of men. She has always capitalized man's stronger sex urge for her own interests and to her own advancement. By trading subtly upon her sex charms, she has often been able to exercise dominant power over man, even when held by him in abject slavery.
Okay, so they must be wanting to make an additional point about this, so they're bringing it up again. The old feminine wiles thing, or womanly wiles, either way you want to say it, depending on how alliterative you want to be. But that, you know, the paradox, you know, you have this juxtaposition side by side, right? There's sort of these two opinions, if you know, in play side by side and in contrast, you know, that's what they want to flesh out a little bit more here.
Early woman was not to man a friend, sweetheart, lover, and partner, but rather a piece of property, a servant or slave, and later on an economic partner, plaything, and childbearer. Nonetheless, proper and satisfactory sex relations have always involved the element of choice and cooperation by woman and this has always given intelligent women considerable influence over their immediate and personal standing, regardless of their social position as a sex. But man's distrust and suspicion were not helped by the fact that women were all along compelled to resort to shrewdness in the effort to alleviate their bondage.
Mm-hmm. Right, so now you're really seeing the paradox that they were talking about. What are these two side-by-side facts here? You can have this immediate and personal standing, but society at large, they could be, held in almost no respect at all. Okay, but and so again, you're seeing, like we were stressing, how they're leveraging off of that foundational aspect of the male. They don't have a paternal instinct, but they have a sex urge. It's like, okay, I can work with that. Let's leverage off of that. And at least, I can, in the immediacy of that leverage point, I can improve my standing. But beyond that, beyond the ends of the teeter-totter, as it were, right? I mean, it can be very, very different. So that paradoxical state of affairs. Let's see, anything else there? In the middle there. I want to just highlight it every time they're doing it here, because it all seems so basal, what we're talking about. So they throw in things like, has always involved the element of choice. So you just notice when they throw in the word choice, so that there's some personal fact entering in. And cooperation by women, right? So, that whole super additive potential comes into play unexpectedly very early on. There's personal nature in play that can produce a super additive consequence even in the midst of a pretty primitive mores system. Men and the women are living in. They're just reminding you that between the lines when they use a word like choice or real. Okay?
Choice, the father aspect brings about the Trinity, cooperation. That's a...
Decisions are relative to time and choices are relative to eternity. You're just bringing in the spiritual, the father, right? Eternity, the transcendent, et cetera, yes.
The sexes have had great difficulty in understanding each other. Man found it hard to understand woman, regarding her with a strange mixture of ignorant mistrust and fearful fascination, if not with suspicion and contempt. Many tribal and racial traditions relegate trouble to Eve, Pandora, or some other representative of womankind. These narratives were always distorted so as to make it appear that the woman brought evil upon man, and all this indicates the one-time universal distrust of woman. Among the reasons cited in support of a celibate priesthood, the chief was the baseness of woman. The fact that most supposed witches were women did not improve the olden reputation of the sex.
Okay, so they're laying it all out there. Why you can look up that French expression in your English dictionary, chercher la femme. she's getting this chance to kind of exercise her creativity a little bit in order to improve her immediate state of affairs, but it has consequences. You got to love that description there. There's no turning off the sex urge in the man, and so it's not just fear; it's fearful fascination. Right? Yeah. It's actually kind of exciting but scary. right?
Not straightforward.
And so they're basically just laying out, what should be obvious, if anyone reflects a little bit, of we have a very muddled state of affairs to try to sort out. There's lots of suspicion and mistrust and misunderstanding. And I'm using that mis prefix purposely, right? Because I tend to think of evil. You got witches involved there and everything, right? See, but all of it is, to a degree, is inescapable because not only the sexes have had great difficulty in understanding each other, and they always will, right? That's not going to change. Right? They basically can't understand each other. That's why they've had great difficulty in understanding each other. So we have to somehow face that fact, right? And develop a harmonious system in spite of that insurmountable divide, right, that separates us. We're never going to really understand each other's perspective, no matter how much we reflect and try to put ourselves in that orientation. It's always going to be just an indirect understanding. You're never going to get a direct understanding. When they bring up Eve, when we read about Adam and Eve, we tried to notice that they were pointing out, don't interpret this, in that old mode. Well, there's a problem. Look to the female, right? That's got to be the source of it. Sure, Eve had her part in it, but it's not like Adam rose above it. He just lowered himself right down with the problem. Not to mention the harshness of, condemning, that woman to death by having sex with her. Anyway, we have all of this kind of darkness, the relationship between men and women, has to contend with is built up over all these centuries.
Even before it happened, Adam was neglectful of Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And
or like I pointed out, not just those technical things like Adam's neglectful of Eve or what, both of them were disillusioned on day one, okay? that's where it really all started. It's not like Eve was disillusioned and Adam wasn't. No, they were both disillusioned on day one.
He was preoccupied.
Yeah. Sure, that disillusionment plays out differently because men and women are different, but right, it was already, over when it started. Like I tried to point out when we went through that. Yeah. Okay, let's keep going here.
Men have long regarded women as peculiar, even abnormal. They have even believed that women did not have souls. Therefore, were they denied names. During the early times, there existed great fear of the first sex relation with a woman. Hence, it became the custom for a priest to have initial intercourse with a virgin. Even a woman's shadow was thought to be dangerous.
I'm not going to touch her. You touch her.
That was probably some old, ugly
phrase. Yeah, it's like, wow, there's a contrast to that whole celibate thing. Okay, but remember, and I purposely brought that up, you can remind yourself of the precision. Remember, there's a difference between celibate and chaste, right? I mean, celibate just means he's alone. He's not married. Doesn't mean that he's not having sex, right? And so you can actually have, him being, you know, the initiator, you know, of every female here in the village, and still be celibate, unmarried.
Time to take one for the team.
It's like, oh, another virgin wants to get married. All right, I'll counsel her. That's rough being a priest back in those days. Yep. Yeah. Just to, I want to remind you of how, when humans want to kind of get their way, but they have various ideological or taboo things, don't underestimate how clever we can be in coming up. It's like, well, technically, celibate only means. Right, just think about how politicians get, how they'll try to get you to really hold on to some minute technicality, to get their way. Right, that scheming mentality that we all have when we resort to technicalities to keep it going. All right.
Childbearing was once generally looked upon as rendering a woman dangerous and unclean. And many tribal mores decreed that a mother must undergo extensive purification ceremonies subsequent to the birth of a child. Except among those groups where the husband participated in the lying in, the expectant mother was shunned, left alone. The ancients even avoided having a child born in the house. Finally, the old women were permitted to attend the mother during labor, and this practice gave origin to the profession of midwifery. During labor, scores of foolish things were said and done in an effort to facilitate delivery. It was the custom to sprinkle the newborn with holy water to prevent ghost interference.
All that's relatively straightforward. Remember, those groups that participated in the lying in. Remember, they had that whole bit where the guy was, stopping work, in advance of the birth and all that stuff. Remember how they pointed out before that all of this just awesomeness and fear and, and whatnot is all about blood. Remember, it's all predicated on the magical mysteriousness of blood. And because blood is just everywhere, when you're talking about the whole reproductive process, that's where all of this, even a woman's shadow was thought to be dangerous. I mean, I see, so the, remember, but that's all predicated on just the fear associated with the blood involved in everything, like they pointed out before. And just a whole bit of old women being permitted to attend a mother during labor. These women who are, have gone through menopause, so that, all of that scary stuff involving blood is over. It's like, okay, well, maybe they can approach them and, and somehow all of the magic doesn't happen and we all die because of it or whatever.
Continued on until very recently. Bloodletting as a medical practice passed out, 100 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
200 years ago at the most.
Yeah. Yeah. So, there's still a lot of people that won't give blood, not because, it's... the needle prick is scary or something like that. It's just that's sacred stuff, and you're playing with God or whatever. I mean, you see, they're still caught up in that, the magical mystery of blood.
That's where the life principle is.
Right, the life principle or whatever term, people use. Yeah, right. They don't just think of it, well, that's the stuff that, flows through your plumbing. They don't think of it in practical terms. They think of it in mystical terms. Okay.
Among the unmixed tribes, childbirth was comparatively easy, occupying only 2 or 3 hours. It is seldom so easy among the mixed races. If a woman died in childbirth, especially during the delivery of twins, she was believed to have been guilty of spirit adultery. Later on, the higher tribes looked upon death in childbirth as the will of heaven. Such mothers were regarded as having perished in a noble cause.
So, it kind of completely flips sign, the rationalization scheme. But notice what's consistent. There's something mysteriously, transcendently profound going on here. And it's just whether or not you interpret it negatively or positively, but still. And no matter how primitive we are or have been, there's a truth there. Because eventually we have to all come to recognize that these children we procreate aren't really our children. They're the father's children, right? We aren't creator beings, right? Creation is happening through us, not from us. When we're in circuit in the Holy Spirit, given a personality, though there is a vague recognition of such truths. That subsequently play out in all sorts of kind of ignorant, primitive beliefs and stuff. But nonetheless, you can follow those practices back to the truth of the motivation behind them. An unconscious even motivation behind them. Be more accepting of it. And we need that in this world, like we stress all the time, because there's people in the most primitive states still. At the same time, we have us sitting in this room, with visions of light and life dancing in our heads. Okay? We need to be understanding and respectful of people at every stage of the evolutionary process. On this planet, it's a very difficult planet in that regard. Very challenging planet in that regard. That is very atypical. As we stress all the time, normal worlds have a very, very narrow bell curve. Very narrow distribution of developmental states of people on the planet. Ours is hardly a bell curve. It's like almost it's so broad. It's practically flat. Right. We've got that challenge to deal with. Isn't it interesting that, the mysteriousness of twins, brings in this superstitions and it's got to be spirit adultery. Again, like I was saying, it's just when there's so little scientific understanding, and there's just endless ignorance, that's where all the superstition comes from. You're not going to just, you're going to come up with some rationalization scheme to deal with this mysterious phenomenon. We're never satisfied to just shrug our shoulders. We always have to think we understand what's going on. Right? And you just dream up fanciful things until you have a rationalization of it. If you're in quantum mechanics, you just add terms to your equations until you get the correct answer, right? Humans have always done that. Okay.
The so-called modesty of women respecting their clothing and the exposure of the person grew out of the deadly fear of being observed at the time of a menstrual period. To be thus detected was a grievous sin, the violation of a taboo. Under the mores of olden times, every woman, from adolescence to the end of the childbearing period, was subjected to complete family and social quarantine, one full week each month. Everything she might touch, sit upon, or lie upon was defiled. It was for long the custom to brutally beat a girl after each monthly period in an effort to drive the evil spirit out of her body. But when a woman passed beyond the childbearing age, she was usually treated more considerately, being accorded more rights and privileges. In view of all this, it was not strange that women were looked down upon. Even the Greeks held the menstruating woman as one of the three great causes of defilement, the other two being pork and garlic.
So there you go, women. You're right there with pork and garlic.
Well, I just heard that
line. That's one of the funnier lines in the book. But you go, oh, yeah, that whole bit about garlic somehow has an effect on vampires. And all these points of you know, fixation for the mystical, you know, pork, you know, and why, you know, it's a religious thing, you know. It's like, you know, for, you know, and it's like, why is pork a religious thing? Right? You know, why is garlic a religious thing? Why is menstruation a religious thing? And I mean, you know, it's for different reasons, obviously, but, you know, when all is said and done, they all have that same supposed spiritual power, right? And are, you know, and play together to a degree. Even amongst the Greeks, see, they're pointing out with all of their initiating reflective thinking and all that, but still, it's very difficult to get out of all the old wineskins of superstition.
Well, pork bellies.
Yeah. Yes. If it's not wineskins, it's pork bellies of superstition, yes. You see, like I was saying, the blood thing, like I was stressing before, how that was just so fearful. I mean, they had no clue why she's bleeding, right? It's just, you know, it's just terrifying. That's all they know. A terrified person has all sorts of imaginative visualizations. Let's see. There. What else is there? There. You know what's coming up here. The flip side of this is, it's like, well, this all seems negatives. Yes, but, you know, it's sort of there between the lines with, what about this 1 week off? So let's see what they say here.
However foolish these olden notions were, they did some good since they gave overworked females, at least when young, 1 week each month, for welcome rest and profitable meditation. Thus could they sharpen their wits for dealing with their male associates the rest of the time. This quarantine of women also protected men from over-sex indulgence, thereby indirectly contributing to the restriction of population and to the enhancement of self-control.
Yeah, so, again, yeah, like I find, yeah, the evolutionary process appears to work in mysterious ways, but you're starting to get it now. It's like, aha, I get this. This is all very clever. You can see how this is obviously on every world, right? And this is how, coincidentally, quote unquote, right, women get the chance to spend a little reflective time by being ignorantly quarantined.
Was that after the brutal beating?
No, it's before the brutal beating. Oh,
yeah. Sharpen her wits.
Yes. The week came before.
The week came before.
That doesn't make sense. You have to recover from the brutal beating.
She wasn't clean yet.
Yes. But again, see, like I said, you know, they have no idea why she's bleeding. It's like, well, this has to do with, you know, this must be spirits, you know, doing something, you know, we've got to somehow, yeah. But no one dares get nearer until it stops. See, so it's not before, it's, yeah, so.
You know, when that beating's getting close, it's like, well, I still have a red rag here. Suffering my wits.
Yeah, so it's, It's just all of the ignorance, but in spite of how foolish, like they said, however foolish these, no matter how foolish we are, right, there's this vast conspiracy called the evolutionary process where we progress in spite of ourselves. We are given we are given the gifts of grace in spite of ourselves. Say it that way even. And so if you can somehow, set aside your emotional response to a lot of these things, you can just marvel at how this works. But again, I'll stress in saying that, remember, all of this progressing in spite of yourselves, that's the first phase. The book is here because they're trying to challenge us to get into that mode, that second phase, where you progress more and more because of yourself. Right, it's more and more personality managed, and not just naturally happens that way through a complicated circuitous evolutionary process. Right, it starts to get more direct because it's more and more purposed.
That first mile, second mile thing.
Yep. All right, let's keep going here.
A great advance was made when man was denied the right to kill his wife at will. Likewise, it was a step forward when a woman could own the wedding gifts. Later, she gained the legal right to own, control, and even dispose of property. But she was long deprived of the right to hold office in either church or state. Woman has always been treated more or less as property, right up to and in the 20th century after Christ. She has not yet gained worldwide freedom from seclusion under man's control. Even among advanced peoples, man's attempt to protect woman has always been a tacit assertion of superiority.
Okay, so I think, most of that is pretty straightforward. Notice the little zinger at the end. There's a lot of women that, push that idea. And, men get upset about it. But see, they're challenging men a little bit, right? Has always been a tacit assertion of superiority. So, men do need to recognize that women have a point there. It's such a minefield. I'm trying to point out, it's so easy to unwittingly overplay these things. I mean, because, like they pointed out, choice and stuff is kind of unconsciously involved even, and it's just so easy to bring in inappropriate existentialization of this, and not think of it more dynamically, see more relatively to the situation and whatnot, but like I said, there's this tendency to absolutize, or existentialize, not be properly attuned to the moment. So that's one of the main things they're doing there. It's just reminding you of how if we're going to work out these issues between men and women, everyone has to really take their game up a notch. This requires a lot of sophistication of thought.
Otherwise, it's immature and primitive. To look at these tendencies and say, get behind it. Because you want to transcend it to a certain extent and make it a little different, even though it still will be the tendency.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, let's get that last little paragraph there.
But primitive women did not pity themselves as their more recently liberated sisters are wont to do. They were, after all, fairly happy and contented. They did not dare to envision a better or different mode of existence.
See, again, that they did not dare. I mean, it's not like, I'm envisioning it, but I'm going to stop that. Or, I mean, it's just the, remember how they, you know, they tell you that in the past, the mores system, and especially the taboos, were just so absolutely identified with. I mean, you just, your mind didn't even initiate things outside of it, you know, that you then had to somehow, you know, pull back on the reins. I mean, it just, you know, your mind was just, you know, ruled with a rigid authority by the mores system, and you just didn't think thoughts. You know, it's not that you negated them when you thought them. You just didn't think them in the first place. And it's very difficult for us to, because we have more liberated minds, for us to even imagine that. It's like, well, how could it not just, you know, occur to them? But then when I say it like that, you probably go, oh, yeah, I have had a number of times where something just didn't occur to me, and there was a problem. And afterwards, I go, how did I not think of that at the time? See, that reminds you, you know, just a simple example of how easy it is for your mind to get into a state where these unexamined assumptions just completely rule the moment, and you're going, how could that be? How could I have not thought of option B there? You know, how did it seem like there were no options and all there was A? Yeah, it just, you know, and you're just befuddled afterwards. You know, so just expand on that. Think of that in a more just, you know, universal state of affairs, right? You know, and when you're just ruled by the mores system.
Self-pity is not a positive thing.
No. Yeah.
They're largely free of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. So again, it's, you know, ignorance is bliss. Right? You know, it's like, oh, I want to have a more liberated mind. Are you sure? Do you recognize all of the difficulties you're going to face now? You know, how you're going to have to overrule tensions that weren't there before now. You know, or somehow do something productive with those tensions and not have those tensions be self-destructive. Like you're saying, like self-pity. You know, that's a downward spiral. yeah, so it's, like I said, it's, you know, when you're pushed out of the sheltered bays, it just gets nothing but complicated.
Yep. Well, Jesus, one of the reforms he did 2,000 years ago with his family was he instructed the women to do, you know, everyday tasks, or he encouraged it in the family, mm-hmm. which was unusual for the time yeah. amongst the Jews.
Yeah.
You know, so that they could feel a certain degree of independence.
Yeah. Yeah. They just
in the society and make a living for themselves, independent of having to overly depend on the man to do everything.
Yeah, and of course he had a higher purpose to that. You know, there's the immediacy of, like you're pointing out, right? So that, you know, well, what if something happens to your husband? You know, can you manage the financial affairs yourself or whatever? I mean, there's those immediate practical issues. But the bigger picture is, you know, he's encouraging the women in his family, Jesus is, you know, to engage material pragmatism at the same time they engage spiritual idealism, so there's a potential for the superadditive consequence of some cosmic consciousness. Some potential to be genuinely human, right? And not just a male or female blob of protoplasm. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a, you know, and as they, we'll get into that next time. They're really going to now bear down on that challenge, that direct challenge to women. Now that you have some newfound freedoms, what are you going to do with it? Do you recognize all of the, how much of a double-edged sword this all is? And you know, how many challenges you face now as a sex?
I think we're pretty used to also the idea that modesty is like jealousy. It's not natural.
Mm-hmm.
You're not naturally modest any more than you're naturally jealous.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nurture thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So. we'll carry this forward a little bit more next time here. See where it takes us. Let's just take a moment here for a little reflection, everyone.